oppressed and the just and those who are the righteous. This is what Islam invites us. And for a believer having an Islamic lifestyle, this is an essential. This is not something good to have. This is something that Quran and Hadith and history and the lives of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, they have taught us very clearly. So choose sides, choose the side of the oppressed, not the oppressor. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S. quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. And every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, the governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance on China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and, of course, the attack on Syria. This is... the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council. And, it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defense of war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on 6 Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why the analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. which plus American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asmaa al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. Figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired. They are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
A group of 17 countries have united in defense of the United Nations Charter. The group seeks to form a coalition to promote multilateralism and counter the use or the threat of force and sanctions against other UN member states. The coalition, known as the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations, includes Iran, China, Russia, Palestine, Syria, Venezuela, North Korea, and Cuba, as well as several other countries. The group has called for dialogue, tolerance, and solidarity. And that these are the core of international relations and vital for the peaceful coexistence among nations. The group's concept notes said unprecedented attacks against multilateralism have put the global peace and security in jeopardy, adding that imposition of coercive measures and the withdrawal from global agreements were signs of growing unilateralism. That is while all 17 members of the group were under sanctions during the former U.S. President Donald Trump's time in office. For instance, the Trump administration imposed sanctions against Iran over its peaceful nuclear program, China over alleged technology theft, and Russia over the 2014 integration of Crimea. Under Trump, Washington announced plans to quit the World Health Organization, pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, the UN cultural agency UNESCO, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has pledged to reverse Washington's previous course as he rescinded the withdrawal from the World Health Organization and returned the U.S. to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. However, Biden has maintained the sanctions already in place against Iran, as well as against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Syria, and other countries involved in the 17-party Group of Friends, proving that Washington has no plans to put an end to its hostile and illegal sanctions.
I think it's a very significant move. The United States announced after President Biden's inauguration that we were back on the world scene. And I think expected that everybody would make a sigh of relief and everything would be fine. But I don't think that's quite what's happened here. The Chinese and the Russians and, 17 other nations or more have signed this declaration to work through the United Nations to end the kind of unilateralism, unilateral interference in foreign affairs. Clearly, that's aimed at the United States.
Members of the Group of Friends coalition have railed against Washington's sanctions and intervention in various statements. A good example of Washington's unilateralism is its withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal unilaterally and rescinded hundreds of sanctions against Tehran. Since the U.N. Security Council Resolution 1737 was passed in 2006, the U.S. and the European Union have been the biggest supporters of sanctions against Iran in order to hamper its peaceful nuclear program. They have both passed numerous bills to impose ever harsher sanctions, including Washington's failed maximum pressure campaign. Last month, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. sanctions against Iran have inflicted the country's economy with $1 trillion worth of damage. China has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop its illegal unilateral sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the anti-Iran sanctions by Washington, calling them anti-human. However, despite being a failed policy, Washington continues its futile approach. According to the report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period.
After all, if we talk about the Middle East, it was the United States who withdrew from the nuclear accords. That's an act of hostility. And then to blame the Iranians and say, unless they do something, we're not going to come back. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we face. And it is one that's going to have to be overcome politically in this country before there's going to be a change.
A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. has attempted to change other nations' governments 72 times between the years 1947 and 1989 during the Cold War. Finally, when the U.S. continues to apply sanctions for its own political gains and gets away with it, or when the Israeli regime breaks the most U.N. resolutions, essentially making the resolutions ineffective, doesn't that put the U.N. institution's purpose under question?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Brother Abu Muhammad, he is my co-host on Youth Station. I am Zainab. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of the show.
Okay, so it's nearly Eid Nowruz, the Iranian Eid. Is that correct? Is
yes.
It a specifically Iranian
New
Eid?
Year, yeah.
But there are Islamic, there are a'mal to do on Nowruz, which is a bit strange. If it's an Iranian Eid, then why are there a'mal on Nowruz? What's your take on that?
That's a very good question. But first, to clarify for our listeners who are not familiar with the term in Iranian culture, Nowruz literally translates to new day.
Yep.
It means new day, and it is the Iranian New Year, which is celebrated around April, right?
With the 21st of March, actually.
Around April, nine days shy of April, which is 21st March. And it marks the beginning of a new year through spring.
Yeah.
Where nature comes back to life and...
So it's literally a new year.
It
is. It's a real new year.
And I think it's beautiful that it starts with spring. I'm kind of confusion about the English New Year.
Yeah, but if you think about it, Nowruz, which is the new year in Iran, would not necessarily be a new year for other countries. Like other countries at this time of the year would have a different season.
Yeah.
So...
But a lot of countries in the region that have the same season as Iran celebrate it as well. Tajikistan, Turkmenistan,
they all
Afghanistan.
Have roots in Iran.
So it's a very Persian thing,
I
would say. And that, again, brings us back to your question, that if it's such a Persian thing, why are there deeds and rituals recommended by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam to be performed on this day?
I was thinking about it as I was coming here. The question is valid. How authentic are these? So there's two ways we can look at it. We can look at everything through their literally through their authenticity, and a lot of things go out of the window, and that's an easy way to take things. The other way is to see that who are those people who have brought these narrations in their books, and perhaps give a benefit of the doubt, but like understand that their understanding of the Islamic literature and the text and their understanding of history and where these ahadiths come from is much stronger. So although something seems a bit weird that why is an Iranian event being reflected in Islamic literature, it sounds a bit funny, but it's not a reason to just disregard it and say, oh, it's not authentic. Yeah, there are other things that would come and have an effect on a narration. So it's possible.
The fact that, well, I've seen only one, but that's probably because of my limited knowledge, most definitely. But I've only seen one source that has cited such recommendations from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, I believe, and it was Mafatih al-Janan.
Okay. First of all, this is a nice thing that that one of the philosophers have said, that when something, when you hear something, put it in the box of possibilities. Don't just deny it and reject
entirely
it straight
right.
away, right? That's not the way to do it. Firstly. Secondly, we have certain general principles, which are, for example, that the scholars were godly people. They were very careful in attributing things to the imams, okay, and so on. The other thing is, we can also give a possible explanation of why we have such a hadith, right? For example, like, I'm not saying this is real, this is exactly why it's happened, but I can say this could be the case. That, for example, you might have, because a lot of Shias were in Iran, and because a lot of Islam was in Iran, right? By that time, Iran was quite dominated by Islam. It's possible that that culture was also coming into Arabia, and therefore the Imam might have mentioned something about Nowruz, because these are now our people, they're Muslims, right? It's possible, okay? We can't just disregard it because, you know, Islam came to Arabs, so only Arab things should be relevant in Islam. If, for example, a European might have come and Imam saw that there's value in one of these European events, then he might have mentioned it.
But they didn't because Europe was so far away. Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
What do you think, how many New Years in your life, and as in how old you are, how many different New Years from different parts of the world have you seen and experienced?
Like,
yeah,
if you're asking
my
age, then yeah, that's out of question. If you're if you're asking how many different types of news
exactly
I've seen,
how many different types
so
of
the
years.
Standard, the English one, the
mm-hmm.
Gregorian calendar, and then the Iranian calendar, and the Islamic calendar,
mm-hmm.
which changes every year. So
when do but the Muslims, when do they? They don't have New Year
of course
per se
they have a New Year.
That they celebrate.
Oh, they celebrate it, but in a different way. They cry in it, not.
Again, for us Shias, we commemorate Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam because the new year, the Islamic new year, the Hijri new year. But in general, Muslims don't have that sort of new year where they go out and have
celebrate
fireworks
it,
and this and that.
Yeah.
We usually celebrate Eid al-Adha or Eid al-Fitr instead. And there's a Gregorian new year, which is like everyone goes all out and gets drunk, which is, again, has nothing to do with us. But we have Chinese new year, we have Indian new year, we have
Indian New Year? Does India have its own calendar? A bit weird.
I don't
think they have a New Year.
But they celebrate. They have celebrations where things are. And what's Diwali then?
Type Indian New Year, and I get January 1st. Diwali is the 5-day festival of light celebrated by millions of Hindu. Diwali, which for some also coincides with harvest and New Year celebrations, is a festival of new beginnings and the triumph of good over evil and light over darkness. So they shouldn't be celebrating Diwali in these days.
Like, we've got the Chinese New Year.
Yeah, we've got the Chinese
New
Year.
And we've got the
sure.
Indian Diwali. It might not be New Year, but they still start celebrating things that are
new. Yeah, we celebrate things as well. Yeah,
and
okay.
They harvest new crops and this and that and then new light and what else? There are New Years in the African Kwanzaa. We've got Hanukkah, which is similar to Christmas, but it still celebrates things being newified.
Are you making the New Year so general that it's about celebrating something new? Because then all of our wiladas are the start, the birth of one of the ma'sumin, which is a new event. So we also have those kind of celebrations.
No, I'm talking about things that celebrate something, a new turn in the universe.
A turn in the universe.
Right?
Okay.
I know that the ma'sumin alayhim salam are the very axis pivot of the universe, but we're not going to get to that mystical philosophical aspect of religion. I'm talking about these.
Okay, then I would say then the Eid al-Fitr would be one of those, because the Eid al-Fitr is like the start of a new spiritual year where you just cleansed yourself through Shah Ramadan, and now Eid basically means to return. So you've returned to the Lord in terms of spirituality, you've purified yourself, and now you're starting a new year. And
that
is actually
very beautiful, especially because for us Muslims, the whole New Year's resolution that a lot of people have, we have it during the holy month of Ramadan.
Exactly, exactly. Basically, Eid is the start of when we're going to start implementing our New Year's resolutions. Yeah.
And a lot of traditions and customs that other people have for their New Year, like I know for a fact that in Nowruz, people go to visit their family members and their close friends, and they gift each other,
and
they wear
exactly
new clothes.
And we have exactly that in Eid.
And we have exactly that in Eid al-Fitr. So I think that's a very cool similarity. And like you said, Eid al-Fitr is definitely something, an occasion where we celebrate things being new and starting fresh and having a clean slate. Awesome perspective. Are you familiar in any way with the Nowruz traditions in Iran?
Not too much. I know a few things. I've lived here for a few years now. I've seen a few things. I'm not a very social person, so I haven't gone and looked too much into.
I think a few cool traditions that Iranians have during their new year is, like I said, the tradition of visiting their relatives and their close friends.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
So,
they're not going to be doing that this new year
because of the coronavirus. Ronas. Yeah. Now, since you're a social person and you've definitely then seen what Iran is like, can you explain to us what's the seven scene?
Iranians have this really cool thing, which is that they have seven items on their table every new year. And the names of these seven items start with seen, one of the letters of the Iranian alphabet, and also the Arabic language. I'm sure other languages have it too.
It's
and
the S, basically.
Yeah, or S. But then apple doesn't start with S in English. But in Farsi, it does. It starts with S, right? And they've got apple, they've got vinegar, they've got coins, they've got green stuff. Like
those limited things that started with a scene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And each of it is, well, basically it's symbolic. You know, the apple symbolizes life and fertility, and the coins obviously represent fortune and money and wealth, and the other thing represents knowledge, and the other thing represents love, and they have a little goldfish too. So if you are in Iran during
cool
this time
of
the year, you're gonna see street vendors and stalls all over the country selling little goldfish, and it's the most adoresy thing. Another thing that's really, really cool that I think Iranians do during this time of year is that they go on spring cleaning.
Okay.
Which I think is awesome. Okay, awesome in two ways. Number one, if you are not a clean person naturally already, automatically, spring cleaning is a great time, though it will be a very tedious procedure. It is a great time to, you know, renew yourself and your home, cleanse it of all the negative energies and the dust mites and the dust bunnies and the spider nets and all the things that you've hoarded throughout the year. If you're already a clean person and you keep your house, you know, tip-top, in good shape throughout the year, this shouldn't be a very hard thing to do. But in general, Islam, I think, emphasizes on this as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And nadafata min al-iman, right? Yeah. Cleanliness is a part of religiosity and faith.
So that's why Nowruz, although even if we might argue that it has no basis in Islamic traditions, itself has really good Islamic, follows Islamic values and
exactly.
morals. So one is cleanliness, the other one is visiting family. And one of the most beautiful thing for me in Nowruz, like, because I have a bit of a philosophical mind, so I try and see things, I give value to things that are based on reality. And Nowruz is based on the starting of a new season, the starting of spring. And I think that's the most beautiful thing. And we can learn a lot of lessons from that. And I think it makes sense to start your new year on something that's based on reality. To start on 1st of January because nothing happened, just because the 1st of January, that's really useless. But you start it because I won't say the whole planet, because other parts of the world are still in winter and summer at that time. But the country you're living in, everything, nature in your country is starting
exactly.
from scratch
the
again.
Planet as far
and
as
you're
know.
Sort of synchronizing yourself with nature, which is a really beautiful thing. So I like that part of Nowruz, to be honest. And I can see why also then, because, now again, the philosophy mind speaks here, because everything around you, the whole of nature is coming back to life, I don't see it as a very a far-fetched thing to think that Allah would have given us specific a'mal on this day so that we also can renew ourselves spiritually through those a'mal. So there is a sort of basis for these things, okay? Nowruz may have certain basis in Islam. We have some very few traditions that mention Nowruz. One might claim that they're fabricated and have no authenticity, but we could also give a reasonable reason of why Nowruz has some value, because it's based on reality, and also we could potentially fathom the
philosophy behind the philosophy it all.
Behind
sure,
it. Yeah,
in that
that's
word.
Right.
Yeah.
So I hope that was a beneficial session, a beneficial show, and looking forward to see you guys again soon.
Thank you so very much for being with us on Youth Station. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I understand that you were born in Iran, but your family moved to the United States when you were 7 years old. So what are your fondest memories of celebrating the New Year?
Well, when I lived in Iran, the one thing I remember the most about Nowruz was that for the weeks leading up to it, the city just palpitated with joy and excitement. Because Nowruz is a holiday that's celebrated by everybody. So the young, the old, Muslims, Christians, Jews, everybody would get into Nowruz. So it was just a very exciting time when everybody seemed to be happy and nice to one another. Even like the taxi drivers.
Well, that's saying something, isn't it? Well, and we're excited. We're going to try to create some excitement. Tell us what are some of the things that we should be doing if we want to participate in the excitement.
Well, just grab any Iranian friend you have and go to their house, because what you'll see is an amazing array of sweets. And then we have something called a hafsin. Let's just say it's akin to, let's say, a Christmas tree. Everybody has it in their house. But seven things, which in our language start with the letter S. When the new year arrives, the tradition is that you go visit your relatives, but you always start with the oldest one first. And so it's this wonderful, respectful holiday. And I think it makes people happy to be old, because it is really a great respect to go to somebody's house first. And so it always starts out, you go and you visit your oldest relative, and then you go, and of course you eat a bunch of sweets at their house. And then you go to the next relative, and then you eat a bunch of sweets at their house. And then you go to the next relative, and the pattern continues. And so, you know, very similar to Thanksgiving. You know, you're terribly bloated afterwards, but it's so nice because it's an excuse to take time out of your way and to visit all of your relatives.
Well, I think this is exactly the kind of holiday that a lot of us can get into for all kinds of reasons. So, Fedorizza, what are you going to do on the holiday? Are you going to are family members so spread out now that it's hard for you to maintain that tradition, or what do you do?
Well, you know, actually, for the past 25 years, I lived away from my family, but just this year, I moved closer to them. So, the moment when the new year happens, I will be at my sister-in-law's house, and my parents will be there, and my mother is going to bring her signature dish, which is resh de polo, which is a noodle rice. And my sister-in-law is going to have sabzi polo and mahi, which is rice with a fried fish, which is the traditional food of Nowruz. And, of course, you know, lots of other little side dishes.
And sweets.
So we'll be there at the moment that the new year arrives.
Wonderful. And finally, you know, I should have asked you this at the beginning. What is the proper greeting? I said Happy New Year to
yes.
you initially.
No, that's
but
right. Salih no Mubarak in Persian. We say Salih no Mubarak. Or, you know, Happy New Year works too.
Good to know. Okay, let me try.
Yeah.
So, Eda Shema Mubarak, Happy New Year.
CO2 is not a lone actor. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "We're Destroying Our Life Support Systems." Studies suggest the Amazon now contributes to warming. Stay tuned for the details, please. wine, recent research has raised alarm that tropical forests, including the Amazon, could soon stop serving as carbon sinks. A first-of-its-kind study from 30 experts that takes into account other greenhouse gases suggests the world's largest rainforests may already be contributing to the warming of the planet. The new analysis, published recently in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change, considers not only carbon dioxide, CO2, and its impact on the global climate, but also that of methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N20, black carbon, biogenic volatile organic compounds, BVOCs, aerosols, evapotranspiration, and albedo. What the authors do that's important is to expand the conversation beyond carbon dioxide, which is what 90% of public conversation is centered around. Patrick McGonigal, Associate Director of Research at Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, told National Geographic, CO2 is not a lone actor, added McGonigal, who was cited in but not involved with the research, which was funded by the National Geographic Society. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. As 15-year-old climate activist Alexandria Villasnor put it in a tweet about the study, we are destroying our life support systems. We are running out of time. The recent study notes that after a transient period of reduced deforestation and increased optimism, rising agricultural conversion and illegal logging activities are again accelerating Amazonian forest loss. This resurgence has renewed concerns that the region is rapidly approaching a catastrophic tipping point. Data from the Rainforest Foundation Norway revealed recently that human activities have destroyed 34% of old-growth tropical rainforest and degraded 30% worldwide. Over half of that destruction since 2002 has been in the Amazon and neighboring South American rainforest. Under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, whose country is home to the majority of the Amazon, deforestation hit a 12-year high in 2020. Cutting the forest is interfering with its carbon uptake. That's a problem. Christopher Covey, lead author of the new study and a professor of environmental studies at Skidmore College, told National Geographic. But when you start to look at these other factors alongside CO2, it gets really hard to see how the net effect isn't that the Amazon as a whole is really warming global climate. The study says that despite some uncertainty, we conclude that current warming from non-CO2 agents, especially CH4 and N2O, in the Amazon basin largely offsets and most likely exceeds the climate service provided by atmospheric CO2 uptake. We also find that the majority of anthropogenic impacts act to increase the radioactive forcing potential of the basin. Given the large contribution of less recognized agents, the paper continues, noting that Amazonian trees alone emit about 3.5% of all global CH4, focusing strictly on carbon uptake and storage is incompatible with genuine efforts to understand and manage the biochemistry of climate in a rapidly changing Amazon basin.
Thank you.
Covey and his colleagues told National Geographic that reversing the damage that's already been done will require halting emissions from fossil fuels around the world and reining in Amazon deforestation, along with reducing dam building and increasing efforts to replant trees. The Amazon is among the most biodiverse places on the planet. The ongoing coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the importance of conserving and restoring rainforest, not only because of the climate emergency, but also to prevent future zoonotic disease outbreaks. As the pandemic, officially declared a year ago, has killed more than 2.6 million people and sickened over 119 million worldwide, experts from across the globe have repeatedly called on humanity to heal its broken relationship with nature.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly.
What I want to say is that when the Islamic government was established, it brought up certain ideals derived once again from Islam and the Holy Quran. Before the formation of the Islamic government, they used to be mentioned in the form of a dream. Some people might have thought about them as unattainable dreams. Ideals such as administration of justice, lack of tolerance in the face of oppression, the non-existence of arrogance and oppression, leading a pure life, the moral transcendence of humans, and other such virtues and ideals. These are Islamic ideals and have been brought up by the Islamic Republic, but before the revolution, they could not be implemented in practice. Well, in order to attain these ideals, certain tools are needed.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
ابزارها هم که ما رو به اون آرمانها برسانه باز در خود منظومه معرفتی اسلام وجود داره بلا شک.
The tools needed to help us attain those ideals exist undoubtedly in the ideological system of Islam, because it is impossible for Islam to introduce us to a certain destination and to encourage us to reach that destination without showing us the path. Such a thing is impossible. The path has been showed to us in the book and in the Sunnah. Now, the Islamic government wants to reach those ideals. Therefore, it should look for and find the tools and instruments for achieving that goal, which are part of the spiritual and ideological concepts of Islam. Then it should use them and move forward. In fact, they are software for the hardware of the Islamic government. If you consider the Islamic government as a hardware, without a suitable software, it will not be of any value. The software is the ways and methods for achieving the ideals and the continuation of the path. Therefore, what I want to say today is that the Islamic government needs such a software.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees, a scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and violates the rights of equality enshrined in the Constitution of India.
In the state of Assam, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh have long been a source of concern for India. Accordingly, around 2 million residents were left off the National Citizenship Register, a majority of them Muslims. The register is a list of people who can prove they had entered India by March 1971, right before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country.
Analysts say the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party aims at transforming India into a majoritarian community by granting citizenship rights to majority groups. And all this has dented India's democratic image globally and has downgraded India from a democracy to an electoral autocracy. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, in, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination center, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels city. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and
underdelivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland.